Welcome to Moolala, Money Made Simple on SiriusXM. Here's your host, Bruce Sellery.
Hello, I'm Bruce Sellery. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple on SiriusXM. The year was 1984. The film was The Terminator. Remember Arnold Schwarzenegger with that legendary line, "I'll be back"? Well, perhaps the next film in the series will be titled Terminator 6. Financial advisor, because it appears that the investment industry might be going half human, half robot. How cool is that? Then we're going to talk about the gender dynamic in investing. Men and women often invest differently, but why? Is it gender? Is it circumstance? And what impact do these differences have on their net worth over time? We'll put those questions to Dr. Ray Yao, Associate Professor of Personal and Financial Planning from the University of Missouri. And who you gonna call? I like these movie references. Who are you going to call? If you had a problem with someone in the investment fund industry, who are you going to call? Well, we'll talk about the Investor Protection Clinic based at Osgoode Law School, a pro bono service offered by students there. Plus, all you can eat for one price. That's the idea behind a new flat fee mutual fund. There is lots ahead, so let's get started. Risk-taking is an important part of investing. If you take zero risk in your portfolio, inflation will eat into your purchasing power over time. And yet, women have a tendency to take less risk than men. Why is that, and what can be done about it? Dr. Ray Yao is an associate professor of personal and financial planning at the University of Missouri. She joins us now from Columbia, Missouri. Hello there.
Hi.
First, what differences do you see when looking at gender and risk?
In prior literature, including the earlier papers that I did, I observed women was less risk tolerant than men. So in this piece, I wanted to know why, and I found that income uncertainty affected women and men in different ways, and that explained the risk tolerance difference.
And what does that mean? What does it mean, income uncertainty?
Income uncertainty, in this questionnaire of Survey of Consumer Finances, they asked respondents, do you expect your income in the next year be the same as this year, or higher or lower? Do you have any idea? You know, so people, if they say same, then they don't have income uncertainty. But if they say, I don't know, or if they say, I expect lower or higher, then we categorize that of people having income uncertainty.
And how much of that is real and how much is it perceived? Because I can imagine there are some respondents who would just psychologically feel worried. They're maybe more pessimistic in temperament, or they had a circumstance in their past that would have them be concerned. How do you pull that out of the mix?
You know, this is a very good question, Bruce. There is no way to, because the question asked the respondent, how do you, what do you think? So you can say that it's their perception. However, I mean, it's only asking them for their next year. So I suspect that people have some, good questions. Say, for example, if you're in a sales job, then it's hard for you to say that my income will be the same. Does that make sense?
Yeah. But if we take the sales example, would it be now we're making a case out of anecdotes here. But if you think about the stereotypical male salesperson who's like, oh, yeah, this is the biggest year ever. I'm going to hit the ball out of the park. And someone of the female gender might be, I'm going to work really hard and who knows how it's going to go. They might answer the question differently, even though the female is the one who is actually hitting it out of the park when the fiscal's done.
I guess you made a point. You have a good point. So it is perception, and it depends on your, profession. So, if people ask me, I'll say, well, same, because we didn't get a raise this year. Yeah.
Is there any way to look at your research through the lens of income groups? Does it differ if someone is living paycheck to paycheck versus someone who's, got it made in the shade? They've got a significant nest egg and their, university education or whatever. Is there any way to further illuminate the case there?
Yeah, we did control income and net worth, and we did find that income and net worth, net worth had a positive effect on the willingness of taking financial risks. So wealthier people are, more likely to say that I'm I'm risk tolerant. I can take above average, or I can take substantial financial risks.
So how do you solve for this issue? If we are to support women in making investing choices that will support their financial well-being over time, and we feel like this is a variable we need to influence, I don't know why I'm saying we, but the world, what are some of the ways you can come at it?
The main takeaway point of this piece of study is that women who reported income uncertainty were the least risk tolerant, and men and women who reported no income uncertainty were in the middle, and then men with income uncertainty were the most risk tolerant. So
were the most risk tolerant.
Risk tolerant.
So if they're uncertain about their income, they're very high risk. They have a high risk tolerance.
Yes.
Wow. So they're like, I don't have a job next week, but I'm going to Vegas and I'm going to win at the tables. Here's what I'm doing.
Yeah, maybe that there are some people like that in the group, although I didn't ask, the question didn't ask him, did you lose your job?
Yeah.
But I suppose that could be true. But you made a point anecdotally. We see that more males are gravitated to sales jobs. That in nature does not guarantee your income. But anecdotally, we know that females, because of the life events, for example, they're the ones who are giving birth, right? And, they're more likely to give care to their family members.
Yeah.
So their income uncertainty, I suspect, anecdotally, come from the life events like that. So if they expect a certain income, it's maybe because they're preparing for those period of time.
Do you think there's more for us to do to educate investors about the importance of risk? And I ask because I had a listener recently write this, question of advice. She had GICs that were fully insured at a credit union, a house that was paid off, and a full defined benefit indexed pension. And she was very, very worried about her GICs going to zero, which actually cannot happen because of the insurance.
Right.
Can't happen.
Right.
And even if it did, she'd be fine. So I don't know what more can be done to help that mindset to say, listen, like the risk that the future you're living into that is so terrifying simply cannot happen.
Right.
How do we get at the psychology of the that?
I think the best way is to show them, like, look, you don't have uncertain income. You have your mortgage is paid off. You have guaranteed income, your defined benefit plan, unless your employer goes broke. And that income disruption in the future is something that you don't have to worry about. But then on top of that, when you do need to invest for your some people, if they downsize, they use their home equity, and if they use their defined benefit payments, and they think it's okay to cover their retirement, which, if that is the main investment goal that they have, then they're fine. We don't have to push them to invest more. But if they know that they have a gap, when they retire, which means their defined benefit plan and their house equity, if willingly sell the house, are not going to be able to cover their living expenses. Mm. Then they do need to think, well, how am I going to prepare for that?
Yeah.
Right?
What would you say is helpful and what is harmful when it comes to talking about gender and investing? Because this is, this can be a contentious topic. We don't want to be sexist in our approach. We want to acknowledge that there are some differences and work to improve outcomes for everyone. But so what's helpful? What's harmful?
Helpful would be, these are the two ends of one question. So, it would be helpful for us to really figure out their true risk tolerance level and find out what's causing them to say that I don't want to invest. This female that you mentioned who has, full equity and also has defined benefit, and if she is overly conservative, then ask why. And same for men. The harmful is that if we have a stereotyping and say, oh, research finds that females are less risk tolerant, let me give you a less risky portfolio advice, and that would be harmful.
Send them all to Vegas. Terrible idea. Well, there's so much more to
this radio.
Yeah. Dr. Yao, thank you so much for your time today. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Bruce.
Dr. Ray Yao is Associate Professor of Personal and Financial Planning at the University of Missouri.
Listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
They're called cyborgs, half robot, half human, and they play prominent parts in movies like The Terminator and RoboCop. Soon, they may play the role of financial advisor. Kendra Thompson is the Managing Director of Wealth and Capital Markets at Accenture. She joins us now. Hello there.
Hi, how are you doing?
Which is your favorite movie from the 80s? Is it Terminator or RoboCop? If you had to choose, like you had to choose.
I'd go Terminator.
Of course, because I'll be back, right? It goes without saying. Yeah, she's amazing. What does cyborg financial advice look like?
Well, I think what it looks like today and where it's going varies greatly. Today, you're basically looking at digital asset allocation, simple tools. They don't look that different, frankly, than many of the things that investors have been playing around with in calculators or in direct investing online experiences. Tomorrow, they will be more sophisticated and ultimately, we hope, also very human. And we really see the future. We use the term hybrid advice instead of cyborg.
Cyborg is really more sizzly, just
I know
for the record.
It is more, it is more fun. But ultimately, we do see the future really around hybrid advice, the bringing together of those advanced analytics and machine learning capabilities with the humans that service and support and validate advice for consumers.
What role do you think advisors will play? You use the phrase in your report, decision validators. What does that mean?
Well, a couple of key things to unpack there. One, we see no downtick in the demand for advice across any asset class, across any age demographic. And as a result, we believe advice and consuming advice is going to be part of the value proposition for the foreseeable future. We also do not see any sustainable place for models that don't include humans in some way. And this concept of validation is the most important one. Even the most self-serve oriented investors, even those who are very happy to do most of it for themselves, will seek human validation. Am I doing this right? Have I filled in the tool properly? Have I made the right decision? That validation is true even in the direct transactional space, and it will increasingly be true within the hybrid space. Beyond that, we also see humans in support and servicing roles, and certainly we see a place for dedicated and semi-dedicated financial advisors for certain consumers as well.
Perhaps fewer, though, because if you could do so much of it with the help of a machine, you wouldn't, in theory at least, need to spend so much time on each account.
Exactly. So the idea here is really around scaling and democratizing advice. Scaling is in the best interest of banks and consumers as well. It drives down the cost to serve and allows advice to be delivered in more ways for lower fee. Democratizing is really around empowering investors, making it more easy to understand the principles and paradigms that underpin advice, and making it easier for them to touch and feel and in some cases, make decisions on their own. What we see is that advisors will move from serving, let's say, 200, 250 client families to maybe 600. And certainly some of today's advisors will retire out of the market and be replaced with advisors in different career models, maybe not in the same model of the advisor of today. We also see a place for licensed humans within contact centers, virtual advice channels, and certainly we see much more roles for industry experts, for instance, tax and estate experts across a broader part of the investing experience. Right now, they typically only step in with that high net worth or ultra high net worth family office type of investor. And we're looking at scaling them as well. So it's not just about the investment advisor.
One of the other interesting phrases in your report, wealthier investors are more likely to feel they can invest as well as their advisors. Isn't that kind of worrying, given that most of the money is made with high net worth clients? It sounds like their value prop is in question.
Yeah, I think the value prop of the industry is in question, full stop. That does not need to be a doom and gloom message. Just like all industries, wealth management is being disrupted. And just like all industries, we must ensure that we can understand what investors want, what they're willing to pay for, and deliver on those needs. And it's no longer enough to just justify what we've always been doing for a fee. So yes, we see the role of the advisor or the firm fundamentally changing. You're no longer on the other side of the desk. You're no longer access, expertise, advisor. You're now partner, coach, mentor. You're one of many advisors. And I think it's important to understand that it is not threatening to the industry to have consumers that feel empowered and want transparency and control. It must be the challenge that the industry meets.
I think it's deeply threatening. It's deeply threatening because the model is so predicated on Canadians in a commission-based model. I mean, one of the other data points that really struck me was that you found half of survey participants said they'd prefer a flat fee with additional costs for add-ons. Very, very few people, 17%, preferred a commission-based model, and yet that's where most of the business is.
Right. If organizations are not willing to fundamentally change, you're right, they should feel threatened. We have it on good authority that most of the leaders in this market are already starting to pivot, and we're helping them do that. So I feel energized because I can see the industry reinventing its value. But certainly, the paradigms of advice are no longer resonating with today's and certainly not tomorrow's investor. And if we keep the status quo, we will not succeed in winning those investors. And ultimately, that could destroy the industry. I see the industry moving already. So I feel pretty optimistic that they're heeding the call and they're understanding the preferences of investors are changing. Go ahead.
You have a global perspective, given the role that you have. Where does Canada fit? Where are we great? Where are we not so great as it relates to the transformation underway in the industry?
A fascinating question. And one of the things I like most about my job, having the global role, allows me to see these trends emerging everywhere. The U.S. is out ahead. Somewhere between 36 and 48 months ahead of Canada, certainly. And the U.S. has a different starting point with more monoline players and more digital disruptors. Canada is doing a couple of things really thoughtfully. One, the integration of both sides of the balance sheet and the connection between retail banking and wealth is something inherent within all of the bank-owned wealth management firms, and I think ultimately really tied to what consumers want. I think also, there's a much more thoughtful and less reactionary approach from our conservative banking system than what we've seen in the U.S., where there's been some sort of flash in the pan, what I would say kind of one-off experiences, trials that we don't believe have legs. I think the Canadian market is moving slower. Certainly, Canadian investors are demanding change at a slower rate than American or Asian or even some European investors. But they are demanding the change and the banks are moving. They're just being very thoughtful about how to do it without causing any unnecessary damage to the portfolios and the client experiences that they support. So I feel like Canada is going to not be the first in a lot of these trends, but definitely going to take the time to get it right. And certainly we're hoping to help the industry learn from the lessons outside of market.
You have tons of perspective looking at all this from the level of 30,000 feet and seeing businesses and big strategy. What would you say to your BFF who has no connection to financial services whatsoever about what they can do to make the most of this half human, half robot future that is heading their way?
Well, I think for sure anyone with even $100 to invest needs to understand how to get the most out of their money. And finding sources of information, educating yourself is key. And so many of these experiences come with education built in, which I think is very empowering. I think it's also very important to understand how the firms and the individuals serving you make money and really make sure that you're comfortable with the way in which they're benefiting from providing advice. I think a lot of investors remain unaware, frankly, of all the fees that they're paying, despite the best efforts of regulators and banks and as well. I think the other thing I would say is you can try a lot of these experiences out without moving money over. What we're seeing a lot, especially from boomer investors, is what we would say is kind of like experimentation, taking a subset of my portfolio, putting it into a direct experience, giving it a try, and looking at the difference between the advice I'm getting right from my relationship and the advice I'm getting directly.
Well, boomers were very good at experimenting in the 60s with, you know, illicit substances. So I think they're the perfect demographic to do that here. Kendra, I wish we had more time. Thank you for giving some of yours today.
Oh, it's been great. Thank you so much for your questions.
Kendra Thompson is Managing Director of Wealth and Capital Markets at Accenture. Well, coming up next on Moolala, we talked about robots as advisors. What about robots as regulators? And later, there's a lot of talk about fees these days. There's another model to add into the mix, flat fee pricing. We'll talk about what it is and how it works. Follow me at Bruce Selry on Twitter, Bruce Selry Moolala on Facebook. I'm not on Snapchat. What do you think I am, 21? Stay with us. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Selry on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
I'm Bruce Selry. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple. Robocops. Regulators are looking at using artificial intelligence to boost their effectiveness. Now, the movie version of their plans doesn't really work for Hollywood in terms of shoot 'em up sizzle, but I think it's a good story nonetheless. Anthony Browright is here to talk more about it. He is the president of Investorcom. Hello there.
Hi, Bruce. How are you?
Do you remember the RoboCop movies?
I do remember.
You're old enough, right? It's like a big cultural phenomenon in the 80s.
There's probably been 3 remakes since I first saw it.
There probably has. I think the metaphor works here in that this half-human, half-robot thing is coming to fruition in lots of different areas. In regulation and compliance, technology has been around for a long time. What's different about artificial intelligence? What's the thread of that that's different from any of the other automation that had preceded it?
So I think artificial intelligence, while certainly in vogue right now, it's in all the media and everyone's talking about it, it's not necessarily a new thing. It is an extension of automation. But really what it comes from and what has changed and why it's right at the fore now is a function of big data. We've all heard and talked a lot about the amount of data that we are now processing. It's only accelerating in growth, as well as in the financial services, the combination of increasing regulation. So in the last 10 years, all regulation disclosure has been on the upswing. And I think artificial intelligence just reflects those two themes and those two trends. So it's taken what was formerly just smart computer programming and business rules and algorithms, and has taken it that next step, incorporating big data and the amount of data that is changing and data sets that we are now processing, and incorporating machine learning and other forms of artificial intelligence to make computers smarter and to process these varying data sets.
I want to look at it from both sides, from the side of the regulator and from the side of the companies who need to file a whole heck of a lot of information to be in compliance. Can you give me an example of how the regulators might use AI? What would they do differently now that they wouldn't have done 5 or 10 years ago?
Well, again, I think what they probably are focusing, I know what they're focusing on right now, are in the areas of risk, fraud. There's lots of talk about anti-money laundering, and certainly a lot of these things that came out of the 2008 financial crisis, where some big, well-respected financial institutions melted to the ground on account of some of these oversights or lack of oversights. And so artificial intelligence is now allowing us to look at all this data, look at some of the patterns and the behaviors that are changing and evolving, and making predictions making decisions based on that.
For the companies, 2 examples that struck me as interesting: copywriting and translation. Tell us about, I have clearly so little about what is required to be in compliance. Is there that much writing that needs to be done?
There is a lot. The thing of regulatory disclosure is, while there has been some paring down of the sheer content that us as consumers and investors are expected to read, there is still a fair bit of it. Some of it is still in legalese, less and less of it, and it's becoming more plain English that we can all understand. But there are reams and reams of content and copy. And surprisingly to some, a lot of that can be automated. And by incorporating logic and artificial intelligence technologies, we can actually generate that content, those commentaries, and even translation to many different languages.
How smart do the can the machines be? So I can see a find and replace. So you've got some disclosure statement, you take out one company name and slap in another company name. That's easy. But how smart can they be where there's nuance?
So that's the thing. And what you just described is really automation. And so you're right. So you can certainly pick the needle out of the haystack and do that across reams and reams of data. But when it comes to things like translation, for instance, from English to French, which is what we do a lot of here in Canada, there's so many nuances. There's probably about 10 different French words for every English word, and no two financial institution would use the same French translation and words in each case. And so artificial intelligence typically helps them learn the behavior within that organization, that FI, that financial institution, and to use the same types of translations depending on the nuance and the types of concepts.
How do these two sides work together, companies and regulators? How do the way they work together? Because it would seem like you would want to have a common foundational platform that you were all on so that it would be simpler. Is that happening?
I think it's getting there, and certainly that's the nirvana for everyone, is why can't we just have a common regulator, for instance, a national regulator? Why can't we have a consistent set of rules across all jurisdictions? And of course, it's very hard to achieve that by starting in any one place, and no one wants to do things all at once. So it is an ideal, easier said than done, but certainly a direction that they're heading towards. I would say that in the 25-odd years that I've been involved in this business, regulators are certainly trying to work more closely with industry and vice versa, really in the interest of finding efficiencies and being compliant, but not holding up business in the process.
How does Canada fit in a global context? So when we think about Canada in AI and in compliance and regulation, are we ahead of the curve, behind the curve? Where would we sit on a list of developed nations?
We're actually well ahead of the curve, and we're developing a reputation. We've always had sort of a hotbed of technology companies in the Kitchener-Waterloo area, and that is still the case. But there are other pockets of accelerators and incubators and tech breeding grounds. Certainly here in Toronto, too, we're growing reputation for fintech and artificial intelligence. And as far as the regulatory regime goes, I think many in Canada would hold us out as leaders in the regulatory front.
Despite the fact that we have 35 securities commissions in this country? I'm kidding. Not 35, but it's close.
That's an aside, Bruce.
Yeah. That was a bit of an exaggeration. Where are human beings important? Where will they always be?
Well, I think certainly in the wealth management place, they will always be a place for advisors and human beings and relationships, because at the end of the day, it is largely based on trust. And so while there was lots of concern and I'll say fear-mongering originally around robo-advisors and whether they were going to displace the traditional wealth management and advice-giving model, I think most recognize now that that isn't the case. They're in some cases being acquired by traditional wealth management firms, but certainly incorporated into the overall service delivery and advice delivery channel. So there will be a place for people for sure.
If I think about compliance of fire extinguishers, for example, sure, a computer could zip around an office building and check to see that they're all in keeping. But I would think that there's a benefit to a human being a part of that process just from an awareness standpoint. It's like, oh, yeah, we do have a fire extinguisher here. How cool. So that if there's a need for one, they'd know where it is. If you automate all of it, do you lose anything?
You do. And I think then you get back to the sci-fi days of the Overlord and HAL from 2001, et cetera.
Right.
So I don't think that's ever going to be the case. There will be a place for human vetting of the final product. In the case of our solutions, our publishing platform, for instance, not to pitch our wares here, but we use artificial intelligence to generate a lot of that copy and translation. In fact, about 90% of it, which drives out costs from the overall process. But in the end, you do need a set of human eyes to make sure that it all hangs together. Yes.
Someone does.
Yes, yes.
All right. One last question. What are the risk factors? What do we need to have in the back of our mind as we think about AI and the regulatory and compliance worlds?
I think there's always a temptation to automate and over-engineer any simple process, and to, in the interest of eliminating the manual and potentially risk-prone errors. or sections of the process. I don't think we want to go that far. I think we need to recognize where do human beings offer the most value. Sometimes it's important to look the person in the whites of the eye to understand that, yes, volatile times, but stick with it. Your portfolio is in good shape.
Right. Anthony, thanks for your time today.
Thanks, Bruce.
Anthony Bowright is the president of InvestorCom. Stay with us. Coming up later on Moolala, the Moolala Questionnaire with Dr. Rui Yao, personal finance professor from the University of Missouri. But next, the Investor Protection Clinic, what it is, how it works, and how you can make use of it. Stay with us.
You're listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, SiriusXM 167.
There's a new resource out there for people who feel they have been done wrong by someone in the investment industry. It's called the Investor Protection Clinic, and it operates pro bono out of Osgoode Law School. Alex Despotovich and Ankita Gupta join me now to talk about it. Hello there.
Hey, how are you?
Ankita, I want to start with you. It's the first of its kind in Canada. This thing does exist in the U.S.
Yeah.
How did it come to be?
Well, many Canadians invest in the capital markets to provide needed income for retirement, to save for a home, or to support their child's post-secondary education. You know, investing is complex, even for those with high financial literacy, and the investing landscape can be challenging to navigate. So there's this real gap that we saw between the investment community and retail investors, and the clinic came from a real collaboration between Professor Poonam Puri at the Osgoode Hall Law School and FAIR Canada, who saw this big gap between the investment community and retail investors and saw that, you know, retail investors need somewhere to go to get real legal advice. And this is what the Investor Protection
right.
Clinic fills.
So, Alex, talk about what the clinic provides. Someone feels they have been in some sort of circumstance that is problematic for lots of reasons. What do they do? How can the clinic help them?
Absolutely. So the clinic offers a wide range of services. Different investment products require different remedies and different avenues. So we tailor the approach to whatever the client has suffered.
How does it operate? Who can access its services?
So any resident of Ontario who's had investment issue occur in Ontario is able to access the services of the clinic, and they can find us either online by emailing us or on our Twitter handle.
And I know listeners out there, if you don't happen to live in Ontario, you're disappointed, but you can lobby your local law school to get this sort of thing started. I know it is a service that isn't available to everyone, but I still felt it was important for us to talk about it. And Kida, what sort of cases do you take? What would be an example mm-hmm. of a type of case?
Yeah. So a couple of examples, like if your advisor has misrepresented the risk of the investments he or she invested you in, if your funds were used in a way that you weren't aware of, if your advisor charged you fees that were not explained to you, if the advisor made too many trades or signed forms on your behalf, basically anything and anywhere where you feel like your investment advisor has done wrong to you and you've suffered investment loss, we can remedy and help you out.
And if the clinic didn't exist, someone would go to a traditional securities lawyer for this kind of service, Alex? Is that the route they would go?
Yeah, traditionally they would. The issue is, however, most of the time, unless the investment loss is over $250,000, it really doesn't make sense to pay those high legal fees, and most lawyers won't take on contingencies at a rate lower than that. So we've really provided a gap in that sense.
And what sort of dollar value are we talking about here for clients that you have mm-hmm. seen? Are they coming over, you know, they lost $5,000 or they lost their entire nest egg?
So we're actually seeing this wide spectrum of sort of cases. It's not just investment in like a certain dollar amount. For some people, yes, it's their total savings, but for some people, it's a smaller amount. Some people have lost money in real estate. Some people have lost money in the stock market. So it's a whole variety of cases that we're seeing throughout the clinic.
Alex, this is a credit course for your law degree. What do you get out of it?
I think aside from obviously the credit, the learning experience is absolutely phenomenal. It's a new clinic, so we're really learning from the ground up in terms of various aspects of corporate and securities law. But at the same time, learning how a clinic comes to be and being able to better understand the investment industry and the issues across it.
You haven't graduated yet, neither of you, I assume. So you must work closely with the advisors. How does that happen? I can imagine if it was me, I have no ability to control my emotions. I'd hear this case and be like, hi, 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 hi. But your lawyers, you can't, or lawyers to be, you can't actually react like that, right?
Yeah. So, I mean, the cases are, we hear the stories, and the stories are obviously heart-wrenching for the most part. People have lost a lot of money. But the way the clinic operates is that we have supervising lawyers who collaborate with us. So when a client comes to us, we listen to their story. We talk to supervising lawyers to get that objective point of view, and then we're able to assist and provide real legal advice to people.
What constitutes harm, Alex? Because, you know, you think about lots of areas. If someone steals my wallet, that is very, very clear. It's against the law. The harm is very clear. In investing, especially in something like risk tolerance, it's a much grayer area.
Absolutely. And that's one of the aspects that the clinic is dealing with. It is a very gray area, and a lot of people don't know whether they've been harmed or not. One instance is suitability. If an individual is has a low-risk profile and they're investing for a short period, often investments that don't kind of confirm to that risk profile can be a harm in some sense.
Right. The quadruple hedge derivative that moves on the value of Bitcoin might not be appropriate for an 85-year-old with no pension. Right. What are some of the most important parts of the law that you need to explain to prospective clients? Because I can imagine some people, I mean, like me, I don't know anything. You would need to educate them a little bit as to what's already on the books that they need to know as their case moves forward.
I think when a client comes to us, first of all, it depends on the nature of their claim. Not all cases are clear cut, like this is the area of law they need to know. So I think we figure out which area of law is most relevant to them. And depending on that, we inform them of processes they can undertake or processes we can undertake on their behalf. And based on that, we move forward and give them legal advice on that. But, you know, it's really hard to say there's one area of law that they need to know because each case is different depending on the different facts of the situation. So it really depends on the client, I'd say, which is why we encourage them to come to us. So at least at the very minimum, we can direct them to resources if we can assist them.
How does continuity work, Alex, on a clinic like this? I mean, I know that there's legal aid clinics that operate out of law schools and have for decades. In this particular case, you're probably going to spend your summer at a big firm somewhere and not be focused on your pro bono clients. How does it work if their case isn't resolved by the end of your term?
So that is an issue that a lot of clinics do struggle with. We do have a lot of kind of institutional memory starting to be built. So having file management systems so that the everything that we've recorded is clear so that the next crop of students will be able to provide those same services. At the same time, we really are committed to our clients. So if it does require going above and beyond in that time, we'll make sure that we do our best to make sure the transition to the next year goes smoothly or resolve it by the time that we leave.
And Kita, what has surprised you the most doing this type of work? Because in your first year of law school, I'm sure it's a lot of casework and maybe, you know, some moots and wearing the funny robes. But now it's getting real. It's getting real. What has surprised you about working with people on this stuff?
I think the most challenging thing that I've experienced is just the aspect of, researching, understanding a client's problem. I mean, often when you're in law school, you know, cases are very clear. All the facts are on the page. Whereas when you're dealing with clients, a lot of times, you know, there's other variables that a client may not realize are relevant and may not express them to you. And when you're working with the client, you realize, you know, these things can help their case. So I think just being able to get the full picture is a challenge, but it's also very interesting because there's a bit of an investigative aspect to that.
Yeah, like Law and Order.
Absolutely.
Wow. Just like on TV?
Yeah.
No, not even really. Well, thank you very much to you both. I appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you very much for having us.
Alex Topatovich and Ankita Gupta are students at the Osgoode Law School. They're also part of the Investor Protection Clinic. Well, stay with us. Coming up next, there are a number of different ways to pay for your investment products, commission-based, fee-based, and paper trade. But what about a flat fee approach? Yeah, I know. Does that make sense? We'll take you through that approach. Plus, we'll talk about the Moolala questionnaire. Subscribe to the podcast version of this show on iTunes. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, SiriusXM 167.
Most Canadians pay for their investment products by way of a percentage of assets. That might be commission-based for a mutual fund, say 2.3% is kind of the average. Or the management fee for an exchange-traded fund at, say, you know, like 0.2%, 0.5%, but that doesn't include the advice. If you have a portfolio worth more than 500 grand, those seemingly small percentages can add up to big money. In the case of the mutual funds, that's like 11%. $11,000 a year. There is a new option with a flat management fee of $1,000. It comes from NCM Investment Management. Alex Sasso is the company's CEO, and he joins us now. Hello there.
Hi, Bruce. Hi.
You're calling it the Z Series. How does a flat management fee work?
So the flat management fee is a relatively simple concept. Essentially, what we do is we charge $1,000 per fund per account to the investor plus expense ratio. So essentially, it is a one-time per year fee that doesn't grow as the client's assets grow.
And what would the expense ratio be in basis points, just so we can have an apples-to-apples comparison? What does that plus expenses mean?
Yeah, so it's your typical expense ratio that you would see on a mutual fund. So it would be generally between, call it 25 and 50 basis points.
Gotcha. So if you had an enormous account, you'd have a mutual fund for about the same cost as an exchange-traded fund, because the $1,000 flat management fee wouldn't really mean much.
That's correct. That's correct. So, for example, if you had invested $500,000 in one of our Z Series products, it would be a $1,000 fee. But if you had that same $500,000 in your traditional mutual fund, that fee typically amounts to $5,000 before that expense ratio.
Mm. How did this idea come about?
Good question. We had been bantering it for some time, because the traditional methodology in mutual funds is to charge as a percentage of AUM. But what we figured out is...
Assets under management, for those of you who need that decoded. Go ahead.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, no problem.
But what we figured out is mutual funds are extremely efficient for smaller investors. So nobody complains when they're $10,000 invested at a 1% management fee, or i.e. a $100 cost. Nobody disagrees that that is a very efficient model, because you're getting professional money management for $100. But as your money grows to, let's say, $1 million or $500,000, those numbers, as you correctly pointed out, Bruce, become a very large number. And so we thought, where does that inflection point happen where mutual funds go from becoming very efficient to inefficient? And we kind of think that number is around $100,000. So $100,000 at 1% is about $1,000. So we thought, okay, there's got to be a better way to price this for clients. And so that was sort of the genesis behind the idea. And we thought, okay, let's apply a flat fee pricing model to large ticket sizes.
Who are you going after? A DIY investor or a fee-conscious advisor?
So we're going after advisors, and we're offering this to them and basically saying, or at least our customers that are advisors that like this pricing option, they're basically telling us, you know, we used to sell you based on performance and service, but now we get to sell you based on performance, service, and now pricing.
So this is not, I can't imagine this is a license to print money. You'd make more money if you stayed the old way. Why did you decide to go this route?
That's a great question. And we decided to go this route because we thought it was a better product for the end client. And we truly believe that. And so we've only offered this on three of our products. And those three products are our core Canadian, our core global, and something called our premium growth class. But essentially with these three products, we have the capacity to manage strong inflows and strong outflows without compromising their mandates. As right-sizing is, right-sizing of our funds is key to our investment philosophy. So we had to be very careful with this Z Series pricing option that it could take large inflows and large outflows.
How would you describe your investing approach on these funds? Because I think some people might hear what you're talking about and think, oh, okay, well, maybe it's just kind of a closet indexer kind of thing, so it's no big deal. It's not that much different than an index fund. What would you say?
Yeah, so let's take our core global product where the Z Series is offered. And with the core global, it offers investors exposure to global markets through a portfolio of really high quality, lower risk securities. So we call it low volatility with active management. And that's the global fund. The core Canadian is the same, only focusing on large cap Canada. And then the premium growth is a single fund that allows investors an access to a range of our different products here at NORAP, and it focuses in on targeting an annualized dividend of about 4%.
How closely correlated to the TSX would your Canadian fund be?
Not correlated well at all. In fact, all of our products are actively managed. So we try to advertise on our website that our funds have something called high active share. And high active share really is the measure of how unique a fund is compared to its underlying index. And it's because we really believe that a fund that is concentrated with our best ideas will do better than one that just passively follows an index over time.
Do you think anyone will follow you with this model?
I think so. This is very unique. It's innovative. It's the first of its kind in Canada. And I think there will be people that will follow us. And I think there's a lot of advisors out there that this makes a tremendous amount of sense for their business for.
So your business, you now have this series, plus you have other products that do not follow this pricing model. If you were to look 5 years out, market share wise, how big a business do you think the flat fee part is?
Very hard to say, Bruce. Very hard to say. What I can tell you, though, is that mutual funds are a $1.4 trillion sized market, and it's a massive, massive market. In fact, we figure about 33% of Canadian households hold mutual funds. So this is really a very narrow niche because, the minimum ticket size for Z Series is $100,000+, and that's where it becomes really efficient. And the maximum is a million. So it's not for everybody. But the nice thing is those same products, we have pricing options that are your standard 85 basis points for our global and 75 basis points for our core Canadian. So they can buy those products in the standard pricing model. And then as that investment grows to a certain size, i.e. 100,000 plus, they can then switch it to the Z series.
Interesting. Alex, we're out of time, but I appreciate you taking some of yours to give us context on this launch. We appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks, Bruce. Appreciate it as well.
Flat management fee is from NCM Investment Management. That was Alex Sasso, the company's CEO. Time now for the Moolala Questionnaire. This is a series of questions about money and about life. Our guest is Dr. Ray Yao, Associate Professor of Personal Financial Planning at the University of Missouri. Hello there.
Hi, Bruce.
Okay, so here's my first question. How would you describe your money personality?
Brave.
Brave. I've never heard that one before. That's great. What do you mean?
Well, I'm risk tolerant. I'm in terms of investing, I am not afraid of taking risks. So that is my money personality.
Where do you think that comes from? Was it always that way, or was that a characteristic that came through life experience?
You know, I great point. I think it came through life experience, my knowledge about finances. And when I was younger, if you ask me, do I want to buy stocks? The answer is no, because I don't know anything about stocks.
And now?
My major is personal financial planning. I know a lot about finances, so I'm confident that I can take care of it.
That is not a degree program or a discipline of study that Canadians that is offered much here. How did you come to that field?
Oh, that is an interesting experience. I had several short-lived occupations before I went to Houston, Texas, and worked for a mortgage company. And I thought at that time, never had a mortgage, so I thought it was interesting. And during that time, you talk to customers and they cry over the phone and say, I can't pay my mortgage. And at that time, I was like, really? Somebody doesn't have money to pay mortgage? Where do you spend your money on? You know, that's the first thing you make sure that you pay to me. But apparently not to everybody. So I thought these people need help. So I looked up online and I saw, several programs in the United States, offer personal financial planning you know, family resource management type
yeah.
of programs. Yeah. So I gravitated to one of those.
What is one topic you could write about, talk about when it comes to personal finance, never get sick of it? You just love it. You're like, woo, this is my thing.
Investment and risk tolerance.
Yeah. This what's one topic you wish you never, ever, ever had to write or talk about again? Someone submits a paper on this topic and you're like, ugh, I can't even market it. So boring.
It's talking about debt.
You are not interested in the debt side. That's good.
I'm not interested in the debt side. I think what to talk about debt, you know.
Just get rid of it.
Just get rid of it.
Mine's taxes. Yeah. I hate talking
Manage
about
it.
Taxes. What is one of your guiltiest spending pleasures?
Junk food.
Really? What kind of junk food? You live in America, so you have these amazing junk food that we don't really have. Like, we don't have a Babe Ruth candy bar. We don't even call them candy bars here. So what's yours? Oh. What's your favorite junk food item?
My favorite junk food item is always potato chips. I know I should not eat potato chips.
Yeah, but they're so good.
For health reasons,
have you ever had ketchup chips?
Ketchup chip, yeah.
Yeah, they're a big deal in Canada.
Oh, really?
What was your worst financial mistake?
I guess that the worst one I would admit it was in earlier years of my career. I did not start a 403B, although I was given a choice.
Right. Okay. Yeah. And when do you plan to retire and what will you do?
Plan to retire about 60, and I already checked with our HR because that's the earliest I can call that I'm retiring and get health insurance subsidy.
Right.
And what I do? I will move to somewhere warm.
What? Missouri's not warm?
Missouri is not warm. It's warmer than Canada, maybe.
It is warmer than Canada.
Yeah, but no, I hate snow. I hate ice. I hate driving on ice. So somewhere warm.
Okay, one last question. If you were to land a huge financial windfall, say $25 million, what would you do with it? Aside from build yourself an amazing home in, I don't know, Costa Rica or Panama or some warm place.
Yeah. Oh, you know, I can tell you I haven't thought about that, but I have. I would really want to use that wealth to understand more about how I can help people who, by my own definition, deserve help.
Mm, that's great. Well, admirable. I hope you save a couple million dollars for ketchup potato chips, because that's clearly important
and
as well.
That
and that
of
too.
Yes.
Dr. Yes. Yao, thank you for your time today. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Bruce. Thanks
Dr. Ray Yao is Associate Professor of Personal and Financial Planning at the University of Missouri. Well, that is our program for today. Hey, listen, you can catch up on past episodes by a couple ways. Go to moolala.ca and click on the podcast. You can head over to iTunes and download the full podcast. You could even write a review on iTunes, which would be awesome. And then you could subscribe so your next episode would just arrive on your phone, your iPad, wherever you have podcasts stored. Please feel free to get in touch. I'd love it. ask@moolala.ca is the email address. You can find me at Bruce Selry on Twitter or Bruce Selry Moolala on Facebook. Thank you very much for joining us, and have a great day that includes ketchup potato chips. I